Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy New Year to you. In this first half hour, we're talking about work being done to improve the pretrial process across Wisconsin. A legislative study committee is taking a closer look at bail and the conditions of release for people charged with crimes. Currently, the Wisconsin Constitution makes anyone charged with a crime eligible for release with conditions that ensure they'll appear in court. In some circumstances, conditions for release include cash bail. Members of the study committee range from lawmakers to law enforcement, and we'll hear from both about why change is needed and what they're hoping to do. Up first, we hear from Milwaukee Democrat and State Representative Evan Goyke.
One of the big issues is that with 72 counties, there are 72 different practices and cultures and standards. We have state law and state constitutional language, but in practice, based on a whole host of different reasons, things work differently in different counties. And that means a criminal defendant facing prosecution in, say, Milwaukee County or Waupaca County may have two different outcomes on a similar case. And what we've also seen, so that's one background reason. And the other is there are seven or eight counties in Wisconsin that have, thanks to national grants, studied their own release practices and have begun using what we call evidence-based decision-making tools to guide the judges and commissioners' decisions in pretrial release. And so we wanted to study that. Are they working? What are the outcomes? Is this something that should be expanded, restricted, et cetera? And so we were looking to just study the practice. And then the third thing is a national movement is underway in really questioning the validity and the value of cash bail. And so some states like New Jersey, the District of Columbia, and now California have begun the process of really trying to eliminate or reduce the use of cash bail in their pretrial detention system.
Okay. And so is that something that you'd like to see eliminated or reduced or?
Yes. There are a lot of conditions on that. It's a very complicated system. But in general, my philosophical or ideological objection with cash bail is that two people facing the same charge with the same amount of money bail over their head may have different outcomes. A wealthy defendant could post bail and get out, and a poor defendant could not post bail and will be incarcerated. And it won't really be about whether or not they're more dangerous or whether or not they'll come back to court. It's really based on whether or not they can pay money to get out. And I don't think that that's fair. And so what some systems have begun to do is decide, we're going to hold people if they're very dangerous, if they're very high risk of not coming back to court, and other people should be released. And it's an idea that we shouldn't have people spending a lot of local property tax dollars in county jails, waiting months on end on low-level crimes, and that if they don't pose a substantial flight risk or public safety risk, that the value of $200 or $400 or $600 cash bail is really not worth the cost of incarcerating people while they wait for trial on those lower level cases.
So are you proposing to do away with it entirely or just low level cash bail or?
Well, that's what the committee is debating. So a little bit of background, because this gets complicated. In states or systems that have eliminated cash bail, what they have put in place is a system called pretrial detention. And it's essentially a hearing in which the prosecutor could move to hold a defendant without bail. So they are held throughout the whole trial without the possibility of being released. And this is the way the federal system works. And what those systems have done is they've said the rule will be release and the exception will be pretrial detention. And that's what the committee is studying. Should Wisconsin move to this system of pretrial detention and the elimination of cash bail? What we've learned over the last several months of studying this issue is that Wisconsin's pretrial detention and bail laws are very complicated. We have two layers of law that apply. One is constitutional language, and the other is statutory language. And what we've discussed and what we've learned as a study committee is that we would likely need to change both the state constitution and state statutes in order to develop and implement a no cash bail pretrial detention system like the federal system or a state like New Jersey has done. And so in that process, we've unveiled a lot of complex legal issues, and that's why we still don't have final draft legislation and why we're going into January, because it wasn't as easy as we thought when we started this search for policy changes.
Okay, and I just wanted to take a step back.
Sure.
I think I might have missed something. Did you say that some of the legislation that you're proposing, this draft legislation, would only take effect if cash bail were eliminated or reduced?
That is something that the committee has debated, and again, it's not final because the committee hasn't had its final vote, and it won't for the rest of the, you know, until the end of January. But what I'm trying to convey is that systems that have removed cash bail have put in place a process called pretrial detention to hold risky individuals, so the highest risk individuals, and that most of the individuals under those systems are released without cash bail, and that we hold the highest risk, highest need individuals. And in order to do that, that is what I have in the committee been calling a grand bargain, and that doing only one of those would leave an incomplete pretrial detention system. If all we do is fix pretrial detention and we're able to hold defendants without cash bail, and we don't have a presumption of release, then we've made our pretrial system more regressive, and we're going to see county jails increase their populations on pretrial, which they don't want to do. And so in my estimation, as a lawmaker, I support the entire package, that is affixed to the pretrial detention statute, but that is contingent on also fixing the cash bail system. And by fix, I mean seriously reduce or eliminate the use of cash bail.
I was reading through some of these draft bills that are proposed under the committee. You know, questions popped out at me from going through them, like, you know, what would you say to people who would argue that these changes to pretrial detention would make it easier to detain people accused of crimes and possibly give courts too much power or strip away protections for the accused?
Yeah, there are arguments have been made to that effect. Most recently, the debate in California became, you know, very high profile over whether or not the idea of eliminating cash bail and adopting pretrial detention was good public policy or worse than the current system. I think that's a policy argument that will play out if these proposed legislation do get introduced. You know, I rely on coming to my policy position. I rely partly on my own personal professional experience as a public defender in Milwaukee County, where I would have clients held for way longer than they needed on low cash bail. And if you think about the population that most frequently comes in and out of contact with the justice system, there are large numbers of people with mental illness or substance abuse or both. And oftentimes they're individuals that don't have the resources to even post $100. I represented a gentleman that spent well over 3 months in jail on $100 cash bail. What was the point of that? That gentleman needed treatment. Ultimately, his sentence was for treatment. But by being incarcerated, he didn't have access to that. And so what we've seen is systems recognize that the outcomes for that individual, my former client, are improved by, instead of incarcerating him on $100 cash bail, release him on a signature bond, but put him in a treatment program and maybe accompany that with some monitoring. So if that's the end goal, if we know that this individual with a history of substance abuse or mental illness, for example, needs treatment and is going to get it at the outcome of the case, why not start it right away? Why hold that person for a month or 2 months or 3 months in jail Instead, let's get them into treatment right away. Let's supervise them in the community. If their crime is lower level, nonviolent, or, you know, the reason for incarceration is reduced, and the justification for community-based treatment is enhanced. And so that's the type of experience that I rely on in guiding my decision, or to kind of guide me to the outcome that I have on this policy area. And again, when we first started talking, go back to the example of two defendants with $500 cash bail for the exact same crime. Fundamentally, I don't believe it's fair that one will be out and sleeping at home because he or she has the resources to post money, and one will not if they don't have the resources to post. That is the freedom is decided not on some hearing or determination of their risk, but whether they can pay, and I don't think that's fair.
So what do you think is the likelihood that changes will be made? I mean, because you've said that this would require, you know, amending the state constitution and state statutes.
Yeah, I think we have a steep hill to climb. This is not easy legislation. It's not, I think it's going to be a challenge in the coming legislative session to see really big change happening. But the study committee this summer has started the process. And what we know is that having a system based on cash bail with kind of 72 counties each doing their own thing isn't necessarily the pinnacle. Like, this isn't, we're not winning right now with the system that we have, and that change is needed. Whether or not the legislature can agree on that change is unclear. But one thing I will say is that a lot of this change is being organically driven at the county level. And so I mentioned before that counties have in Wisconsin have received federal grants to begin this process. That started almost a decade ago with Eau Claire County and Milwaukee County. And both Eau Claire and Milwaukee studied their pretrial release system. They came to different conclusions on what they will change. They made those changes and studied the outcomes. From there, seven additional counties took a look at what Eau Claire and Milwaukee were doing and said, hey, that's a good idea. We should do the same. And so you're seeing this organic drive to make these changes at the county level. And whether it's this session or next or at the end of this session, I do think you're going to see a growing effort to make changes in pretrial detention. And the results are going to come from the counties that are engaging in evidence-based decision-making. They're forming entities called Criminal Justice Coordinating Councils, CJCCs, where DAs and public defenders and judges and sheriffs are talking to each other, and they're starting to put their heads together on what policy choices they can make to make this community safer and also reduce the reliance on incarceration. And that's coming without state law change, but I think we're going to learn, state lawmakers are going to learn from those experiences across the state.
And just to clarify, too, quickly before I let you go, everything I'm looking at here, and correct me if I'm wrong, it refers to pretrial detention. Is there any draft legislation that would eliminate or reduce cash bail right now?
I think that one is a little easier by law. And so in some of that legislation, you may see language that talks about presumption of release, which would be, I guess, going towards or at least pushing towards not using cash bail. I don't believe that there's a bill, and I apologize for not being totally up on the on exactly what's on the agenda in finite detail for the end of January. But what I've been talking about as a committee member is needing to have both of them together. Okay. I think some committee members have argued that because we need to change the Constitution, the fight over whether or not to eliminate cash bail really can't take place until that is first done. And I understand that. I understand the law behind that, but want to make sure, at least personally, that whatever I vote for in that committee will have both a fix to pretrial detention and the other half of that bargain, which is the elimination of cash bail, or the substantial reduction of it.
You were just listening to State Representative Evan Goyke. We want listeners to know that we reached out to the Republican chairman of the committee, Senator Van Wangard, but we did not hear back. Up next, we'll hear from Bayfield County Sheriff Paul Susenka. He's also a member of the committee that's working to improve the pretrial process in the state. What are the things that you're hoping will come out of these discussions as they're looking at changing bail or conditions for pretrial release?
Well, you just said it. The goal really is to be able to make more effective use of pretrial status. We all know people are in pretrial status sometimes for quite a period of time. And some of the inherent problems that lead to criminal behavior aren't addressed, drug addiction being one, other issues. And I think that's kind of the overall goal, and yet public safety is too.
Well, you're seeing a lot more people in the county jail in the meantime, right?
Well, right, and sometimes they're in jail quite a period of time because it's just, for a variety of reasons, takes a while to get these cases adjudicated. They are in a pretrial status, whether in custody or out of custody, and there are a number of counties and places across the country who have pretrial service agencies, which do a form of supervision, try to at least get people to report for court hearings. That's one of the reasons people even get legal trouble. They just aren't able to comply with court schedules to help guide that along. Now, we do in our county, we try to get people to refrain from drug uses or violent behavior or behavior that causes, results in criminal charges while they're facing one charge, kind of form of supervision. But there is limitations. People who are accused of crimes aren't guilty of crimes legally, so they are innocent. So there are limitations of what you can do to compel certain behavior. So we all understand that. I think everybody on the committee is really concerned about liberty interests, along with public safety.
Yeah, I guess that's what my question was going to be is, what do you think can be done then to kind of strike that balance between improving public safety and the legal rights of people who have been accused of crimes?
Well, I think there's a number of things. One problem is just representation. That's another issue. That's maybe a budgetary issue. But if a process could be could take a bit longer, if it had to, particularly if a person was out of custody and subject to conditions of bail, we need ways to encourage people to avail themselves of available treatment and options. There should be some incentive to do that because that's really in their best interest. And some of this is going to probably require to lengthen the time limits, at least not put DAs under the gun so much to get charges filed or to get cases prepared too hastily so that some of the other issues can be addressed. And, of course, one of the things that has to happen is an assessment. And we've talked about that a bit. There's really no standardized form of standards, national, even statewide form of assessment, so you can understand what people's risks are and what their needs are. So you can adopt a plan that may help a person according to what their individual needs and situation is.
So are you kind of saying that there's no way to tell or no good way to gauge the highest risk individuals from the lower risk individuals?
There are, but it's a matter of having time to do that. And not everyone does. It's just not a standardized process yet. Some agencies, okay. Some counties are very good at it. Some aren't able to. And a lot of it has to do with the volume, the numbers of cases. Person's histories, individual histories, tell you a lot about the likelihood of reoffending. That's completely logical. But there are more scientific ways. But there has to be a process to get that done. There often isn't time. A person may be arrested for a crime and maybe before the court for a bail hearing the next day or 2 days later. And there isn't a lot of time to actually do an assessment to see what sorts of conditions the court might want to impose on them when they are released.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
And then if there is a condition or are several conditions that a court imposes, it's good to be able to help a person meet those conditions. So that's almost a form of case management, a pre-adjudication case management, where you actually contact the person if they're willing to be contacted. Discourage, particularly the drug use or alcohol use, which are the most common things. Then, of course, if a person is in jail because the bond is so, say, a monetary bail is imposed and they can't meet it, there are things that can be done while they're in jail to help deal with addiction issues, too. And it's a matter of voluntary participation. I mean, we do that in our jail now. We make every effort to try to deal with these underlying issues right up front. There's a number of things at play here. It's a complicated thing, and there's a lot of, I think there's still some newer drafts of legislation that are going to be coming out. Nothing's really finalized yet. But everyone wants to make this process more effective and equitable. We don't want to see people in jail for long periods of time because they can't meet a $200 bond, for example. That doesn't have any public safety interest, and that really doesn't have any rehabilitative effect either. So we're trying to get this sorted out, and I don't know if all of it can be done legislative. Some of it's policy issues.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just so different across every county as far as how you deal with it, you know.
Well, right, and that, you know, and that can be troubling. I mean, we want to apply the laws consistently as possible. That only makes sense.
Well, is there anything I'm missing that you would like to add?
It is really involved, and like I said, there's a lot of, you know, those committees have a lot of good discussion. They're very, you know, broad variety of perspectives, and that's very healthy. I think the committee has had a lot of good work, good work. I don't know what's going to be done, what the final drafts are going to be as far as the legislature is going to, legislature is going to end up acting on. You mentioned that, you know, there's some discussion about a constitutional change, and that really, the purpose of that is really to get more time, because everyone knows it takes more time, and in a lot of cases, people are probably facing more time in pretrial status than ought to, but it's not due to anyone's intent. It's simply a bogged-down system. But constitutional changes are difficult, right? It has to, the proposal has to pass two consecutive sessions of the legislature and be put to a vote. So, but some statutes, in order to be changed, you realize have to have a constitutional change. Otherwise, you really can't change the law. But the intent is to make this process more equitable and more effective. I think that those are the fundamental goals. I think everybody is on board with that. And certainly, you want the public protected. We don't want people who are likely to commit violence against innocent people to be able to do that. And I think there's a lot of public support for that. But there are so many people who don't fall into that category that constitute the highest numbers of people in the criminal justice system, and we want to make it effective and equitable.
Well, and like choosing who is kind of a high-risk individual, that seems to be kind of a point that needs to be sussed out, right?
And that's where the risk assessments come in, and that's right. That's why you want to use not anecdote necessarily, but you want to have some good proven method of doing that. And there are assessment that would give you some indication, at least, you know, there's no guarantee, but some indication of what the risks are, what the person's need are, what they suffer from, and what their risk of reoffending is going to be, what the risk to the public may be.
Do you have any kind of assessment like that right now in Bayfield County?
We have a very, very simple one, yes, we do. I mean, there were a couple. One, we do a proxy screen when a person is arrested prior to a bail hearing. Is really very simple. And then if people are between arrest and adjudication, oftentimes there'll be a more in-depth assessment, risk needs assessment.
So does that happen before they're incarcerated or released?
It could happen before they're released. There again, it depends. If the person is arrested and is released the next day, there's not a lot of time to do it. Or if the bail hearing's the next day, there isn't. But usually there is a time to do this preliminary screen before a bail hearing. And then after the bail hearing, many are released with conditions, and some if they are not, assessment can be done. They can be ordered in for assessment. That's been done as a condition of bail. If they are in jail, there's a high cash bail, we might do an assessment. There's different periods of time that can happen. Okay. Before a prosecutor is going to make a decision on a plea agreement, oftentimes they want to know information about them. what are some of the fundamental problems? What are their, do they have jobs? Do they have education? Do they have employment? What is their housing situation? What is their criminal history? All of those things that affect the potential for criminal behavior.
Again, you were just listening to Bayfield County Sheriff Paul Susanka. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. People in the Twin Ports are used to seeing ships moving in and out of the Duluth and Superior harbors, but soon Great Lakes vessels will be heading into winter layup as the shipping season ends. Up next, we take a look at how the Twin Ports fared during the 2018 shipping season with Adele Yorty. She's with the Duluth Seaway Port Authority, and she spoke with me yesterday by phone about how cargo volumes moving through the ports compared to last year.
This year is almost mirroring where we were last year in terms of tonnage through November. We had a late season rush on iron ore and grain, which I think surprised folks. It had kind of slowed at the end of September, and I think people were thinking it was going to be a quiet finish. And then we had this flurry of about 15 or 17 grain ships in October and November. So that was a great way to end the season for grain, which put it up 22% through November over last year. So that didn't include a couple of the late season arrivals in December, but that was a nice strong run for grain. We even had our first bulk shipment of soybeans after over a decade. So that really was an indication of a shift in trade patterns that happened, I think, as a direct result of tariffs. When typically those soybeans would go out bulk to Asian markets, market shifts happen, and we were able to move those out through the Great Lakes Seaway system. So that was an exciting twist for the grain side of things. And then, of course, iron ore with all of the taconite plants up at full production. It was, as someone said, a rock-solid year. So iron ore pellet production was up, and so were the shipments of the iron ore through the Port of Duluth Superior.
Well, and just going back to the grain piece for a second, you know, basically you're saying you saw more business related to the tariffs and soybean issue because there was grain being shipped out of here
Europe? I think what we saw was a late season flurry of grain. It was still predominantly wheat, durum wheat, and beet pulp pellets, which is our traditional grain movement, but we certainly felt a fall season rush, which was good to see. It was the one shipment of soybeans in the fall that kind of took everybody by surprise because those bulk soybeans tend to go to an Asian market. That'll be an interesting thing to see if any of that holds up for the start of the 2019 season or not.
So typically that might have gone out by rail, but instead it was going out by ship?
Yeah, the Midwestern soybean farmers tend to move their soybeans bulk by rail out to ports on the West Coast or on river barges to Gulf Coast ports.
Well, and with the steel and iron ore production being up on the Iron Range, I mean, how much of that was driven by tariffs?
Well, you know, what's good for one commodity has a flip side for other commodities. And so while soybean farmers have had to deal with some of the downturn because of the issues with China and tariffs, the iron ore production and steelmaking industries have been booming. And I know that the Iron Mining Association and other folks are really enjoying the healthy trend and uptick in demand. The tariffs really did help in leveling that playing field to prevent the steel dumping that was happening. And in doing so, I know there are some segments that are still struggling, but from our perspective, the movement of the iron ore was very, very strong all the way through fall. And we'll wait to see what the December numbers are up. But the only thing that would keep this year from being another record year is we had a slow start in April, if we all remember back to then. We did have some issues with ice. Late March and early April shipments were down. And so as the year went by, everything picked up. But those total numbers may not reflect just how strong this season might have been had they been able to be moving full strength when the locks opened last March.
So you did see more movement due to the steel and aluminum tariffs, more cargo moving through?
Wouldn't be talking about the aluminum tariffs. That really doesn't impact our port because we don't move that raw material through here. But it seems to have, whether we can directly attribute it to the tariffs, at least there was a strong production, strong demand for this steelmaking industry along the Great Lakes. And if you're going to point cause and effect, I'm sure that there was a definite impact by allowing those steel manufacturers to order domestic product.
Well, what about just like the economy in general? You know, how much of that and where things stand now is affecting the cargo we're seeing moving through the Twin Ports?
Well, that's the other element of us having a strong economy, demand for product, people buying cars, recreational vehicles, new appliances. Consumer demand and buying seems to have been strong all year. So that side of the economy also contributed to demand for steel being up. So we'll all kind of wait and see what happens now coming with 2019 and 2020, because some of the long-term effects of changing supply chains don't happen overnight. And so we're all kind of waiting to see what happens in 2019 when the orders that were on the books now have been fulfilled. What happens with new purchases in terms of commodities, and what happens with shifting supply chains? We're going to watch and see what happens with that as we move into 2019 season.
What about projects in the Twin Ports in the last year? Were there any significant changes that were made that have impacted business in the area?
Well, I know for us, I don't know about as a whole around the Duluth Superior area in terms of investment in various projects. I know for our own terminal, we've been doing a lot of work. We've had a significant play in our intermodal terminal, the CN Duluth Intermodal Terminal, after its first full year of operation. And we are doing putting in some infrastructure projects, started this fall, but will resume in the spring in terms of adding 2,600 feet of track that will assist in being able to have a more expansive container yard. We also have the office remodel that's happening down to our old office to allow for Altec Industries to expand. And we're also over on our 26-acre dock that was put back into service. We'll have some modifications being done on there as well. Demand for warehousing is increasing with our container handling. So that side of our business is really booming.
Again, you were just listening to Adele Yorty with the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. When we come back, we'll take a look back on some of the top news stories and issues in northern Wisconsin and the Twin Ports. I'm Danielle Kering, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. Up next, we take a look back at some of the top news stories and issues for northern Wisconsin last year. And perhaps one of the biggest stories of the year was the Husky Refinery explosion in April that caused a temporary evacuation of the city of Superior. Federal, state, and company officials continued to monitor air and water quality around the Husky Energy Refinery in Superior after the series of explosions and fires that occurred on April 26th. There were no health concerns related to the fire, but questions started to build over its use of a highly toxic chemical that forced the evacuation of the city. Many in Superior heard and felt the explosion, including Jeff Johnson of Poplar. He was working at Petro Choice in Superior, just down the street from the refinery. Johnson said it sounded like a plane had crashed into the building.
I don't know what happened, and I went down in the office and looked towards Husky and just seen a lot of black smoke.
Husky's emergency response team and Superior firefighters quickly doused the blaze, but asphalt leaking from the tank reignited and crews had to pull back. Superior Fire Chief Steve Panger said all they could do for a time was work to contain the fire.
Basically, this product is sort of like lava where it has a flow to it. The product is so hot when it burns that you can't put water or foam on it. You have to wait till things burn off to some extent.
crews and water systems work to cool a tank holding 15,000 pounds of hydrogen fluoride about 150 feet away. Refinery manager Colin Shady says the potential release of the toxic chemical prompted the evacuation.
Fortunately, the engineering and safety design equipment that is in place in that unit maintained its job and protected the first responders and also the citizens of the community.
Shady says the tank wasn't compromised in the fire. It will be part of federal investigations over what caused the incident. But Ron Koopman says the threat was very real. He spent his scientific career studying chemicals like hydrogen fluoride at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory.
It is a very dangerous and hazardous chemical of its own, but it is used in refineries as part of a process. And of course, the chemical and the refinery industry is used to using hazardous chemicals, so this is just one of the most dangerous.
But Washington, D.C.-based chemical risks consultant Fred Millar says the Superior Refinery is taking more chances than it should.
And the reason is that it's using hydrogen fluoride instead of a non-disaster chemical alternative, which is sulfuric acid. Sulfuric acid will not put a big, huge toxic gas cloud into your community.
The Superior Refinery is one of 50 nationwide using hydrogen fluoride to make high-octane gasoline. While sulfuric acid is also dangerous, it remains a liquid and doesn't have the potential to become airborne. The National Petrochemical and Refiners Association has said they've put systems in place to contain any mishaps at refineries and that shifting to alternatives is not easy or cheap. But nearly two-thirds of refineries aren't using hydrogen fluoride. The United Steelworkers Union argues it's worth the cost to protect the more than 26 million people working in or living near a refinery. Superior Mayor Jim Payne says alternatives should be examined.
I think we do need to look at other options, but that's something we're going to be working on with the company going forward. We're still in kind of a public safety and cleanup phase right now.
The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources said in a release that water and air quality monitoring are ongoing. There have been no fish kills in a nearby creek, and air monitors have shown trace levels for toxins below health standards. Governor Scott Walker said after touring the damaged refinery that Husky Energy needs to examine how to rebuild.
Not just go back to where they were, but improve public health, public safety, natural resource management in a way that ensures that people are first and foremost safe.
Federal agencies have said it will take months to investigate exactly what went wrong. Later that summer, the U.S. Chemical Safety Board said a faulty valve likely caused the explosion that led to a series of fires at the Husky Energy Oil Refinery. The board said 36 people received medical treatment as a result of the April incident. The agency's lead investigator, Mark Wingard, says the valve is meant to prevent mixture of air and hydrocarbons in fluid catalytic cracking, or FCC, units. Wingard says a similar corroded valve led to an explosion at a California refinery in 2015.
It kind of behooves us to go to industry, to talk to people, to say, how can we prevent this from reoccurring? What needs to be done to prevent this mixture of flammable and oxygen air to occur within the FCC units?
Debris from the explosion punctured a tank about 200 feet away that held asphalt and later ignited. Another tank within the same range of the explosion held a highly toxic chemical. The risk of its release prompted a citywide evacuation. A spokesman with Husky says they will continue to work with the CSB to understand what caused the incident. Then, in October, the Occupational Health and Safety Administration fined the Superior Refining Company that does business as Husky Energy roughly $83,000 for 8 worker safety violations in connection with the April explosion. OSHA found the company failed to inspect and test equipment to make sure it was fit for service. The agency said those measures could have prevented the explosion that caused an evacuation order for much of Superior. Ginger Jewell is co-founder of the Twin Ports Action Alliance, and she says the fine was a slap on the wrist.
This wasn't the first time this company, the Superior Refining Company, has been cited for some of the serious issues by OSHA. So if Husky really wants to be a good neighbor to our community, they'll make a commitment that they will not continue operations like this.
A Husky spokesman said at the time in a statement, "It is our policy to continuously improve our process safety programs." And this last fall, a review of the Husky refinery explosion found social media caused confusion for emergency crews trying to evacuate people from Superior this past April. When an explosion at the Husky Oil Refinery punctured an asphalt tank and sparked fires in April, Julia Johnson was working at home about 3 miles away.
That one doesn't really match. This one doesn't really either. It's an old this is an addition.
Johnson works at a Duluth nonprofit that gives people information in a disaster or an emergency. But it was Johnson who needed information about what was going on after black smoke began filling the sky over the refinery. People were being told to evacuate, but Johnson says checking Facebook and news websites, it wasn't clear what areas were in the evacuation zone.
I checked one page and it said within 1 mile of the explosion. One said 1 to 3, and then both of them said 3 to 5.
News reports weren't helping straighten it out.
If you're 10 miles south and within 2 or 3 miles to the northeast and west of the Husky Oil Refinery.
Anyone within 5 miles of that facility is now being asked to evacuate.
3 miles on either side, on all sides to the north, east, and west of the refinery, and then 10 miles to the south.
Residents from 3 miles around have been told to evacuate.
Douglas County Emergency Management Director Keith Kessler says there was a lot of confusion about the evacuation area that day. A report on the emergency response points to social media.
Information that was not 100% accurate got out that perhaps caused the evacuation zone to be a little larger than it was originally intended to be. Working with social media can be very difficult. It's hard to control.
A lot of agencies and people were giving out different evacuation orders on Twitter and Facebook, like the National Weather Service and the Superior Police Department. Even Superior Mayor Jim Payne shared evacuation information that wasn't quite right. But he says social media and confusion go hand in hand.
I'm just not feeling terribly apologetic for either myself or anybody else that issued an order for doing so. Once they saw danger, they told people to get out of danger and they gave them the best information they could at the time that they had it.
If the same thing happened today, Payne says they would respond better. He and other agencies have gone through training so that everyone knows their roles in an emergency. Douglas County's Kessler says many had already been through that training, but they're improving how they work together. That includes designating a single point person to share information.
We're going to work more to try to develop a better public information program to try to get everyone saying the same thing at a similar time.
Kessler says there's always a few wild cards, but he feels the emergency response went pretty much by the book. But that's no comfort to Johnson, who returned home that night thinking the fire was out and the evacuation order had been lifted.
They had put it out like a little bit, but it had restarted. So the evacuation was still on until like 9 a.m. for the next day.
Superior Police tweeted the evacuation would last about 2 more hours after the fire was put out that night, but later corrected that post. Johnson says they were trusting emergency crews and city leaders to give them the best information to keep them safe.
I would prefer if they don't know, they say they don't know, and they say it's indefinite because they're putting people's lives at risk, putting out wrong information.
And the actual evacuation area that day? The county's report said it was a 1 mile radius around the refinery, 10 miles south, and 3 miles east and west of the southern evacuation line. And last month, the U.S. Chemical Safety Board returned to Superior, holding a public hearing on the investigation into the explosion and fires at the Husky Energy Oil Refinery. The majority of remarks centered around the refinery's use of the highly toxic chemical hydrogen fluoride. Hydrogen fluoride is what prompted a broad evacuation of city residents. A tank containing the chemical was about 150 feet from the explosion. Susan Hedman is an attorney for Clean Wisconsin and the former regional administrator for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Hedman says they'd like the Chemical Safety Board to make recommendations to improve public safety.
Clean Wisconsin is calling on the CSB to issue a report that includes specific recommendations to reduce the risk of hydrogen fluoride to refinery workers and the public.
Hedman says the refinery should discontinue or phase out the chemical's use. If released, hydrogen fluoride can pose serious health impacts, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Husky and the CSB have said that the tank was not compromised, which Hedman says was nothing short of luck. Jared Hawes is the director of state and local outreach with the trade association American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers. Hawes says the industry meets and exceeds regulatory requirements for using hydrogen fluoride.
In total, refineries only represent about 1.5% of global HF demand, and the remaining 98% are used by a range of industries that make products.
He says the chemical is used in products like detergents, cars, and computers. About 50 refineries nationwide use hydrogen fluoride. Another top story of 2018 was the decision by a special prosecutor not to file criminal charges against an Ashland County sheriff's deputy who shot and killed a Bad River teen. Family members protested the decision along U.S. Highway 2 in Ashland. Some drivers honked in support of protesters holding signs reading Justice for Jason along U.S. Highway 2. A prosecutor said Ashland County Sheriff's Deputy Brock Marjanovich was justified in the shooting death of 14-year-old Jason Puro. But Jason's older cousin, Renee Puro, disagrees.
He had a taser on him. He had pepper spray. He could have called for backup. You know, he was so quick to bring the gun out and shoot. And I don't believe that was right.
The state's findings say the officer shot the teen after he lunged at him with a knife. The knife found at the scene was consistent with those in Puro's home. Bad River Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins says he wants the U.S. Department of Justice to honor the tribe's request for a federal review of the shooting. Another top story in 2018 was when the U.S. men's Olympic curling team brought home the gold. Nearly 1,200 people cheered on Twin Ports Olympic athletes when U.S. men's curlers showed off their Olympic gold in Duluth when returning home. Bagpipes played and the crowd cheered as team members entered beneath a canopy of curling brooms at the Duluth Entertainment and Convention Center. The U.S. men's curlers shared their experiences coming from behind to win gold in the Winter Games. But Duluth's John Landsteiner says it doesn't hold a candle to the reception back home.
The Olympics are great and all, but this is way cooler than the Olympics right now.
Superior Mayor Jim Payne says the team's gold medal win belongs to the entire community.
It belongs to all of us. You belong to all of us, and we're thrilled to have you home, and we're not letting you go.
Team Captain John Schuster of Superior says the medal is something he'll never lock away or put on display because, quote, it's something bigger. And another top story in 2018, flooding in northern Wisconsin. Again, heavy rains poured over the region for several days that caused a number of closures and washouts to roads across northern Wisconsin. A section of U.S. Highway 53 in Douglas County had been rerouted. Water also washed out a portion of U.S. Highway 2 in Bayfield County. Douglas County Emergency Management Director Keith Kessler said the county had declared a state of emergency.
It's a situation where some of the roads are getting undermined and will just suddenly collapse. So when you're driving along, it may look like everything's fine, but there might not be anything underneath you. We've had several instances, both in Douglas and Bayfield County, where people have drove through deep water and been flooded or, you know, floated off the road and had to be rescued.
The National Weather Service said Douglas and Bayfield counties likely saw a total of 12 to 14 inches of rain.
That's an incredible amount of rain to have to fall in, you know, less than 24 hours, and that's why we've got this massive water problem with water moving through all the drainage channels and the rivers right now.
The region contended with record high crests on the Nemadji, Brule, and Bad Rivers draining into Lake Superior. Another top story of 2018, thousands cheering on President Donald Trump during a stop in Duluth in June. The president was touting his work on national security, trade, tax cuts, and his tough stance on immigration at the Mexican border. President Trump accused Democrats of an open border policy that costs the nation billions of dollars and allows drugs to pour into the country.
Democrats put illegal immigrants before they put American citizens. What the hell is going on?
Trump said the U.S. would now try to keep families together. His administration has been under heavy criticism for separating kids from their parents at the border. Across town, people rallied against the president. Superior resident Naomi Lear expressed doubt that Trump would reverse his policy.
The rules need to change to treat people in a human manner, especially children.
Trump supporters said they want to see people enter the country legally and for Congress to take action on immigration policy. And Enbridge Energy was once again a top newsmaker in 2018 when Minnesota regulators approved its preferred route to upgrade its deteriorating Line 3 pipeline that carries crude oil across northern Minnesota to Superior. Tribal and climate change activists gathered at the Minnesota-Wisconsin state line in June to say they will stop the replacement of Enbridge's aging oil pipeline there.
Whose land?
Our land!
What do we want?
Around 15 people gathered on the railroad track separating Minnesota and Wisconsin just south of Superior. They called Minnesota regulators cowards for approving Enbridge's $2.9 billion plans to replace its aging Line 3 pipeline. Honor the Earth co-founder Winona LaDuke says they will stop the line with whatever means necessary.
And we are prepared to defend our water and to defend this territory.
But others support the move, including Jim Caesar with the Development Association for Superior and Douglas County.
This new line will be more environmentally safe than remaining with the old line.
Enbridge CEO Al Monaco said in a statement that their top priority is the safety and integrity of its energy system. Legal challenges against the decision made by Minnesota regulators are still ongoing, and Enbridge hopes to have the Line 3 pipeline in service by the end of 2019. You've been listening to just some of the top news stories of 2018, and that's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.